Here they come. Right now, they're gathering from hospitals all across America for Talk 10 Tuesday. They know there's important news and information just ahead. Don't miss out. Come in, sit down, and log on. It's Talk 10 Tuesday with Chuck Buck and co-host Dr. Erica Reamer. Here now is the publisher of ICD-10 Monitor, Chuck Buck.
Thank you, Clark Anthony. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 378th edition of Talk 10 Tuesday, brought to you today by ICD University. And joining me this morning as my co-host is a very, very popular Dr. Erica Reamer. Dr. Reamer is the founder and the president of Erica Reamer, MD, Incorporated. Good morning, Erica.
Good morning, Chuck, and good morning, everybody.
This morning, our lead story is about avoiding confusion over critical care services, especially when it comes to charging for those services, right?
Yes, there is confusion, and Terry Fletcher will focus not only on the coding, but on the documentation of those services.
Very good. Also on today's broadcast, Bonnie Cassidy returns. She has another report on the mid-revenue cycle.
And Leslie Krigstein returns with her popular segment called Dateline Washington.
That's right. And you have a talkback segment this morning on the need for physicians to treat the whole patient without being preoccupied with DRGs and CCs and MCCs. And I'm really looking forward to listening to what you have to say on that subject. We have much news to report. And we begin this morning with Tim Powell, who's at the Talk 10 Tuesday News Desk.
The Talk 10 Tuesday News Desk is sponsored by ICD University, inviting you to sign up for a free 3-day trial to the ICD-10 Monitor Educational Webcast Series. Click the tab above or visit the ICD-10 Monitor bookstore.
Here now is Tim Powell.
Thanks, Chuck. And today we want to talk about renal dialysis. You may be covered by Medicare, but you could be bankrupt before you're covered. Wikipedia gives a good definition of dialysis. In medicine, dialysis is the process of removing excess water, solutes, and toxins from the blood and people whose kidneys can no longer perform these functions naturally. This is referred to as renal replacement therapy. When kidneys permanently cease to function, the condition is called end-stage renal dialysis, or ESRD. The patient will require dialysis 3 times a week for the rest of their lives, barring a kidney transplant. Physicians and Medicare look at levels of creatinine and urea in their blood, and once a certain level is reached, patients are diagnosed as having ESRD. A common thought about end-stage renal disease is that all patients are covered by Medicare. While Medicare does cover ESRD patients, there are some huge exceptions to this, which could appear to be abuses by the dialysis industry and often leads to personal bankruptcies. The dialysis market is an oligopoly. An oligopoly is a market controlled by a few major players. 70% of all the dialysis centers in the United States are owned by just 2 companies. How this impacts people waiting to be covered by dialysis will become clear in a minute. Once a patient is diagnosed with ESRD, the physician should file Form 2728 to notify Medicare that the patient has ESRD. This does not mean the patient is covered by Medicare, but this form and the dates included will drive the other rules around reimbursement. In general, patients diagnosed with ESRD are not eligible for Medicare for the first 90 days of treatment. If the patient's lucky and informed, they may decide to do dialysis in their home, and they could be covered in the first month following diagnosis. Many patients do not have a home environment that allows them to be treated at home, nor do they have the information available in order to start home dialysis. Now comes the oligopoly and reimbursement issue. While Medicare pays around $240 per dialysis treatment, ESRD providers may charge non-covered patients in the waiting period as much as $14,000 for the same treatment. Although there are over 6,000 dialysis centers in the United States, since they are controlled by 2 companies, the patient can't go to a competing dialysis center for treatments at a lower rate. The 2 competing companies controlling the markets benefit by not competing with each other in this case. Patients with jobs are often forced to quit their jobs for a similar reason. Patients covered by their employer's health plan must wait 30 months before Medicare becomes primary over their company's insurance. As deductible and coinsurance have risen sharply, the cost can quickly overwhelm patients covered by employers. Whether the solution is breaking up the oligopolies or changing the Medicare coverage rules, this has been a longstanding problem, and I'm not sure our regulators are up to the task of fixing this. And with that, back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Tim, very much. That was Tim Powell. Tim is a compliance expert, and he is also the ICD-10 Monitor National Correspondent. It's Tuesday. It's July 23rd, 2019, and on this day in history, the ice cream cone is created during the St. Louis World Fair, and of course, the rest is history. Today, you're listening to the 378th edition of Talk 10 Tuesday.
The
The 2020 Inpatient Prospective Payment System has new codes and coding concepts you should master in order to improve your coding performance. Along with expected changes to operating room designations for multiple procedure codes, these updates put the financial stability of many facilities at risk. Mastering the new concepts, codes, designations, and MSDRG changes will be crucial for compliance and proper reimbursement. With so little time left, let ICD-10 Monitor get you and your team up to speed with an exclusive 3-part Coders webcast series. Join ICD-10 Monitor for these high-impact coding workshops during the ICD-10 Monitor Summer Celebration of Ipsalooza. To register, use the upcoming webcast tab in today's broadcast and save $30 when you enter the coupon code Tuesday.
Here now with the latest regulatory news to come out of Washington is Dateline Washington correspondent Leslie Crinkson. Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning, Chuck. Temperatures and tensions are high here in the nation's capital. While temps hit triple digits over the weekend, pressure was on between the administration and congressional leaders to agree on a budget cap deal before lawmakers leave for their traditional August recess. We've heard now for almost a week that a deal was imminent, but as of last night, leaders and the president have reported that they have an agreement. The deal cancels the automatic cuts that would have reduced both domestic and military spending. While the House has passed some of their appropriations bills, the Senate has yet to move any of them, yet to even release drafts or hold hearings. So they'll have some serious work to do when they return after the month-long August recess. Congressional leaders have stated that they'll be willing to bring funding bills to the floor in September if they pass in a bipartisan fashion out of committee, which could be tough, thus setting up a race against the clock ahead of September 30th. It's not out of the question that we may need a short-term continuing resolution to keep the government funded until the end of the year, or worse, a shutdown. The committees with jurisdiction over healthcare have been busy and have set up some steep timelines for their progress. We know that Congress and the administration alike have voiced a willingness to address issues like drug pricing, surprise billing, and an overall reduction of healthcare spending. Some of the bills approved by the House Energy and Commerce Committee last week seek to address these patient-focused issues. Last week, the committee approved the Community Health Investment Modernization and Excellence Act, which would reauthorize community health centers at $4 billion annually and the National Health Service Corps at $310 million annually through fiscal year 2024. The legislation also approved by the committee last week addresses surprise medical billing, prohibiting balance billing for out-of-network emergency services and certain out-of-network ancillary and post-stabilization services, and set a benchmark or reference rate for out-of-network payments to providers. The bill was amended to add an arbitration process for hospitals and physicians that receive a median in-network payment of more than $1,250. The bill also delays the Medicaid Disproportionate Share Hospital or DSH cuts for 2 years and decreases the proposed cut in fiscal year 2022. Among the other bills considered by the Energy and Commerce Committee last week was a 5-year authorization for grant programs administered by HRSA to develop the nursing workforce. They also provided a 5-year reauthorization for the healthcare workforce development grant programs, including the Area Health Education Centers and Health Professions Training for Diversity program. We are awaiting further action on the Senate Help Committee's Bipartisan Lower Healthcare Costs Act. Meanwhile, the Senate Finance Committee is expected to have a drug pricing markup later this week. Initial speculation was that the Senate would merge these two proposals and consider them at the same time on the House floor. Help Committee Chairman Alexander has expressed his hopes to accomplish this before the August recess, so the clock is ticking. The physician fee schedule is still at the Office of Management and Budget, as HHS has just released the MIP scoring results from 2018 for providers. Moreover, on Twitter, CMS Administrator Verma is calling on the public to share stories about how their health information is shared or how the lack thereof has impacted them. This clearly remains a priority for CMS. Are you concerned about quality measures? We know the administration is. As the president highlighted the need to streamline quality reporting in a recent executive order, applications to join HHS's Quality Summit, an effort to be informed by government stakeholders and approximately 15 non-government healthcare industry leaders who will convene to discuss how current HHS programs can be streamlined to deliver value-based care models focused on improving outcomes, are due next Wednesday, July 31st. As the House looks to begin their summer recess at the end of this week, the Senate will return to business in D.C.
next week before a lengthy district work period. With just a few legislative days before the end of the fiscal year upon their return in September, time is of the essence. Back to you, Erica.
Thanks, Leslie. That was Leslie Krigstein. Leslie is Vice President of Congressional Affairs for the College of Health Information Management Executives, or as we know them, CHIME. Chuck?
Thanks, Erica, very much. And thank you, Leslie, for an excellent report. As we mentioned at the top of the broadcast, Bonnie Cassidy is with us today. Bonnie is a nationally renowned health information management authority, and she's past president of AHIMA. Here now with the Talked In Tuesday Revenue Cycle Report is the aforementioned Bonnie Cassidy. Good morning, Bonnie. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Chuck. Thank you very much. Yes, today I'd like to talk about the revenue cycle. Defining the front, middle, and back of your revenue cycle is critical in order to address the resource requirements that you need in each component. A system running effectively prevents denials of claims and maintains a visible, efficient billing process. Revenue cycle management, referred to as RCM, also encompasses everything from determining patient insurance eligibility and collecting copays to properly coding claims for ICD-10. As hospitals and other healthcare providers struggle to adapt to new reimbursement models, the mid-revenue cycle is becoming increasingly more important for driving financial stability and improvements in quality performance. In general terms, the mid-revenue cycle is defined as the process between patient access and the care provider's patient accounting or business office. The lines between front, middle, and back are often blurred and do overlap, so you're in good company if you find it a challenge to draw clear lines. Some processes are rather fluid and are cross-functional, cutting across the entire revenue cycle. An example of that is monitoring for the current patient identification or medical record number, which is a critical success factor to the front, middle, and back. That's really where we speak about monitoring and managing for duplicate medical record numbers. The mid-cycle has been quoted as being the moment the physician puts pen to paper, or literally finger to key, to document the care that's been delivered and the disease state of the patient, all the way to completion of coding and handoff of the case to the billing system. One of the other areas to monitor is a phrase called cost to collect. That's a trending indicator of operational performance, and it's really one of HFMA's MAP keys. You can find more about MAP keys on the HFMA website, but the interesting thing on cost to collect is that you're hearing it more and more related to the mid-revenue cycle. Cost to collect is one important indicator of the overall efficiency of the hospital's collections management process. HIM expenses that are in the mid-revenue cycle now are recognized as a significant driver in the cost to collect calculation. Providers are increasingly seeking mid-revenue cycle management solutions to ensure accurate clinical documentation and data accuracy. According to recent Markets and Markets report, the mid-revenue cycle and clinical documentation market is projected to reach $4.5 billion by 2023. That's a compound annual growth rate of 7.9%. Really news for the mid-revenue cycle. So in the current state, there's an expanded understanding and appreciation of the importance of the mid-revenue cycle on the overall performance of the entire revenue cycle. As such, we can expect to see significant growth in the right sizing of resources of people, process, and technology in the mid-revenue cycle. Back to you, Erica.
Thanks, Bonnie. That was the past president and chair of AHIMA, Bonnie Cassidy. Bonnie is now the president of Cassidy & Associates. Chuck?
Thank you, Erica. And again, Bonnie, thanks very much. And you can read Bonnie's excellent report on this very important topic in today's edition of the ICD-10 Monitor News.
Staying on top of pressing coding and documentation issues can be challenging, especially when new ICD-10 codes are released. No wonder you struggle to keep up to date. Plus, there's the need of recertification, along with the stress of obtaining continuing education credits. Now, with a subscription from ICD-10 Monitor, you have premium content plus continuing education credits from AHIMA and AAPC. Subscribe to the new ICD-10 Monitor educational webcast series for premium content accessible by in-house and remote staff anywhere, anytime. Now, for a low annual rate, subscribe to more than 40 curated education webcasts. Plus, for a limited time, access a free 3-day trial of the new ICD-10 Monitor educational webcast subscription. To activate your free 3-day trial, go to the ICD-10 Monitor bookstore.
This morning, our lead story is about avoiding confusion over critical care services, especially when it comes to charging for those services. Joining us now to report our lead story this morning is Terry Fletcher. Good morning, Terry. Welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. So despite the increased resources and references for critical care billing, critical care reporting issues persist. Medicare data analysis continues to identify 99291 as high risk for claim payment errors, perpetuating prepayment claim edits for outlier utilization and location discrepancies. Are your critical care claims at risk for denial or repayment upon review? Several payers have identified increased potential for critical care reporting discrepancies, which have resulted in targeted prepayment reviews of this code. Some payers have also implemented 100% review when critical care is reported in settings other than inpatient hospitals, outpatient hospitals, or emergency departments. To ensure a successful outcome, make sure the documentation meets the basic principles of the critical care guidelines. Because critical care is a cumulative service, providers keep track of their total time throughout a single calendar day. For each date and encounter entry, the physician's progress notes shall document the total time that critical care services were provided, so for example, 45 minutes. Some payers impose a notation of start and stop times as well. The provider's time must be solely directed toward the critically ill patient. Highly complex decision-making and interventions of high intensity are required to prevent the patient's inevitable decline if left untreated. Payment may be made for critical care services provided in any reasonable location as long as the care provided meets the definition of critical care. Critical care services cannot be reported for a patient who is not critically ill but happens to be in a critical care unit or when a particular physician is only treating one of the patient's conditions that is not considered a critical illness. 99291, that is used for the first 30 to 74 minutes of the critical care evaluation. 99292 is for critical care evaluation for the additional 30 minutes. It is to be listed separately in addition to the code for the primary service. CPT and Medicare define critical illness or injury as a condition that acutely impairs one or more vital organ systems, such there is a high probability of imminent or life-threatening deterioration in the patient's condition, so circulatory failure, shock, renal, hepatic, or metabolic, or even respiratory failure. CMS further elaborates that the patient shall be critically ill or injured at the time of the physician's visit. This is to ensure that hospitalists and other specialists support the medical necessity of the service and do not continue to report critical care codes on days after the patient has become stable and improved. When a physician and a nurse practitioner see a patient on the same calendar day, critical care reporting is handled differently. A single unit of critical care time cannot be split or shared between a physician and qualified NP. One individual must meet the entire time requirement of the reported service. More specifically, a hospitalist must individually meet the criteria for the first critical care hour, which is, again, 30 to 74 minutes, before reporting the additional 99292 for an additional 30 minutes. The same is true if the NP provided the initial hour and the hospital provided the additional time. But you also may have payers that do not cover NPPs for critical services. It's in the contract language, so monitor your contract. Payers who recognize NPs, again, extenders as independent billing providers, will require split invoices as well. This ensures reimbursement rate accuracy, as a physician receives 100% of the allowable, while the NP receives 85% of the allowable. Consider the following scenarios of patients whose medical condition may warrant critical care services. 81-year-old patient is admitted to the ICU following an abdominal aortic aneurysm resection. 2 days after surgery, he requires fluids and pressors to maintain adequate perfusion and arterial pressures. He remains vent management dependent. 40 minutes are spent attempting to stabilize the patient. Notice the time. A 67-year-old female patient is 3 days post mitral valve repair. She develops hypotension and hypoxia, requiring respiratory and circulatory support. Critical care time, 14:05 to 14:45. Again, notice the time. The examples of patients who may not satisfy Medicare medical necessity or do not meet the criteria for critical care or do not have a critical illness or injury may be eligible for the subsequent hospital care codes or the initial hospital care codes. But those patients would be patients that are admitted to a critical care unit because no other hospital beds were available, or patients admitted to a critical care unit for close nursing observation or frequent monitoring of vital signs. Maybe they had drug toxicity or overdose. Patients admitted to a critical care unit because hospital rules require certain treatments, like insulin infusions, to be administered in the critical care unit, or patients receiving only care of a chronic illness in the absence of care for a critical injury or illness. A patient underwent a double CABG yesterday. This is one of my auditing clients, and is a post-op, and according to the documentation, the patient, quote, reports that he has some slight discomfort near his sternal incision, but otherwise feels well. The physician put 35 minutes of critical care time. This encounter did not meet the criteria for critical care. The cardiologist was asked to co-manage the patient in the post-op period, but did not add any critical care or cardiology value to the encounter. So what was this for? That actually was not critical care time. As far as concurrent care, when different specialists are reporting critical care on the same date, it is imperative for the documentation to demonstrate that the care is not duplicative or for any other provider's care, and the care cannot overlap the same time period of any other physician reporting critical care services. Calculating your time, critical care time constitutes bedside time and time spent on the floor unit where the physician is immediately available to treat the patient. Remember, this is a time-based service, so time must be documented, no exceptions. Activities on the floor unit that do not directly contribute to the patient care or management, such as review of literature, teaching rounds, etc., cannot be counted towards critical care time. Do not count time associated with indirect care as well, or grief counseling for the patient's family. That is another code altogether. For more information on critical care services, how to calculate your time, document, and report your services, please refer to my article today, published in ICD-10monitor.com. Dr. Greenberg, back to you.
Thank you so much. That was nationally recognized professional physician coder and auditor, Terry Fletcher. Chuck?
Thanks, Erica. And Terry, thank you very much for an excellent report. And as Terry said, you can read her reporting in today's ICD-10 Monitor News. Good report. And now's the time for our very popular segment here at Talk 10 Tuesday. It's called Talk Back, and it features our very own Dr. Erica Reamer. Dr. Reamer, what's on your mind today?
Chuck, I don't think about my previous life as a practicing physician much, but I took a little trip down memory lane a few weeks ago when I wrote my article that you will be able to find in ICD-10 Monitor next week. When I was on my pediatrics rotation, I had a supervising resident who probably had the most profound influence on my life. On my career, at least. Dr. Deirdre Bastival was soft-spoken and gentle and kind, but what impacted me most was how she viewed the patient as a whole being. I never forgot how we were taking care of an intellectually impaired youth for I don't remember what, but she noticed he had a very nasal voice. Turns out he was incessantly teased for the way he talked and snored. Several days later, he was discharged minus some adenoids and tonsils. Pretty sure you couldn't fly that past an insurer nowadays. But the point was that she didn't just hyper-focus on his principal diagnosis. Deirdre assessed the patient as a person and addressed all of their needs. I tried to emulate her, and in the emergency department, I would list all the conditions I felt were important to the patient's not well-being. I didn't know, and I didn't care, that this practice would be valuable to the hospital's reimbursement or quality metrics. A while ago, I popped onto Twitter for something and discovered Ron Hirsch had tried connecting me with Dr. Amy Townsend, a hospitalist from Texas. She was complaining about evil fetuses trying to make her diagnose malnutrition when she is just trying to take excellent care of her patients. She was convinced it was all financially motivated, and she wanted CDI and the administration to extricate themselves from her and her patient's relationship. It reminded me of a hospitalist I worked with when I was a physician advisor who refused to document malnutrition as a diagnosis. His reasoning was that he did not feel he was competent to make that diagnosis. He felt it was a dietitian diagnosis. I tried to get him to see that he was considered captain of the ship, and it was his responsibility to corral all the pertinent diagnoses made by him, his colleagues, the ancillary staff, on his patient. Historically, providers only needed a single diagnosis to justify the medical necessity of the E&M level of service. So, they often still only list one. This practice does not tell the story of the encounter, may not support medical necessity, doesn't help the hospital establish POA status, and most importantly, doesn't convey to the next provider conditions which are relevant and important to the care of the patient. In my emergency medicine CDI project, I modeled the diagnoses I would have made and the sequencing. The ED doc documented abdominal pain and hyperglycemia. I counter with 1, right-sided abdominal pain, 2, irritable bowel syndrome, likely cause of number 1, 3, intertrigo, 4, morbid obesity, 5, type 2 diabetes with hyperglycemia. My list tells a story. Patients don't get admitted for COPD. They get admitted for a COPD exacerbation, often compounded by acute on chronic hypoxic respiratory failure. They don't get admitted for a fall. They get admitted for resultant fractures, which need definitive treatment, which came from the fall. Malnutrition matters, not to line the hospital's pockets, but because it is considerably more difficult to cure or manage patients' underlying disease processes without addressing their nutritional status. The Aspen Consensus Statement says it is a major contributor to increased morbidity and mortality, decreased function and quality of life, increased frequency and length of hospital stay, and higher health care costs. Clinicians should recognize diseases, disorders, conditions, and social determinants of health, which put the patient at risk and make caring for them more complicated and costly. We should be addressing them inpatient and setting up outpatient follow-up. They should be documented so everyone knows what was considered and done, and that should be the CDIS's goal, completeness. If you believe the CDIS's are not practicing according to the ACTIS Code of Ethics, you should report that to management, Dr. Townsend. Providers should be like Deirdre. Take care of the whole patient, document what you did, and let the reimbursement fall where it may. Tell the story, tell the truth, and do the right thing. Let me climb back down off my soapbox now, Chuck, and I'll turn it back over to you.
Thanks, Erica, very much. That was an excellent report. And as Erica said, you can read her report next Tuesday in the ICD-10 Monitor edition. We have a couple of questions that we wanted to ask, and I wanted to begin by asking Leslie Kringston, who had our Dateline Washington report. Leslie, in your report this morning, you talked about a number of issues that are being developed and voted upon. Can you give us an update again on the surprise balance billing issue?
The House has done work on a proposal, but they aren't going to be voting on it ahead of the August recess, so it looks like at least the House activity is going to be postponed until September at the earliest. As it relates to what the Senate's working on, a different proposal stemming from the Senate Help Committee, they are still cautiously optimistic about being able to consider it on the Senate floor next week before they adjourn for the summer. So still a long way to go on a final proposal to hit the president's desk, but we're certainly seeing the conversations progressing in both the House and Senate.
Very good. And when is the summer recess coming up?
The House will leave on Friday, and the Senate has one more week, so they will be out starting next Friday.
Very good. Thanks. That's all the time we have, and I know a number of questions came in. We didn't have a chance to answer those questions live, but we'll make every effort to answer those questions in the next day or two, and we want to thank you very much for being with us. This is going to be a wrap for our 378th edition of Talk 10 Tuesday. And Erica and I want to thank our panelists today, Bonnie Cassidy, Terry Fletcher, Leslie Kringston, whom you just heard, Tim Powell, and of course, our co-host, Dr. Erica Reamer. And remember, no matter where you are, you can always listen to all the Talk 10 Tuesday podcasts anytime, anywhere, on any device, and it's absolutely free. You can listen to us on Stitcher, Apple, Spotify, and Google Play. And when you do, rate us. Give us a review. Until next Tuesday, I'm Chuck Buck reporting for Talk 10 Tuesday and ICD-10 Monitor. Thank you again for being with us.
Talk 10 Tuesday is a production of ICD-10 Monitor.